Chapter 23. Bob Firestone was murdered, gangland style, in the early morning hours of March 1950. The police said gunmen had forced the car he was driving to the curb and shot him 3 times in the back. The homicide detective assigned to the case said it was a shakedown, evidenced by a hat left at the scene belonging to a well-known racketeer and bookmaker. Bob was returning from dropping off the bartender and 2 waitresses who worked for him at the Casablanca Cafe. One of the waitresses later told police a man who didn't identify himself called the nightclub at 2 that morning asking for Maxie Diamond, Bob's partner. When he was told Maxie wasn't there, he asked for Bob Firestone, but by the time Bob reached the phone, the caller had hung up. The homicide detective figured the caller wanted to be sure Bob was there and was likely to drive his staff home, as he usually did at the end of the night. Maxie Diamond told the police he thought it was a mix-up, claiming whoever it was had probably been after him, not Bob. He said he and Bob drove the same make and model cars. Detectives determined Bob probably found himself cut off by another car as he was driving, because Bob's car went onto the curb. 6 bullets went through the car, 4 into the body of the car and 2 into the windows. Bob was hit as he was trying to exit the car, 2 in the upper back and 1 in the lower back. At about the same time, 2 brothers in their early 30s returned home and saw Bob's car. They heard the shots fired, but didn't see anyone or the car that had followed Bob. They rushed to the car, pushed Bob to one side, and drove him to the nearest hospital. Bob was able to talk to the police, saying he didn't know who shot him. Bob lingered for 4 hours before dying. His last words were to his brother Max. "I have nothing to say. Take care of the folks." Bob left almost $6,000 in his estate. The money went to his wife, Sadie. He left nothing to Rose. A few days later, 2 middle-aged men accompanied a young, dark-haired woman to the police station where she confessed to Bob's murder. The men reported she told them the story in a nearby cafe, explaining that it was she who'd committed the crime. The woman was pleasant and calm, refusing to tell detectives why she killed the gangster and racketeer. "That's for you to find out," she said. She couldn't remember if she'd used 2 or 3 guns in the murder. The police didn't believe a word of the woman's story. They handed her over to the police matron. Maxie Diamond was questioned in court about the murder. The owner of the hat found at the scene was identified by the cleaner's mark as a bookie and police character who went missing but was later picked up by the FBI. He refused to talk to law enforcement. Diamond said he was worried the same thing might happen to him. The newspapers had a field day with the story, recalling the days of the old-time gangsters and racketeers. The end of Prohibition was supposed to be the end of the gangsters who made money off liquor. Journalists speculated that the death and continued violence were connected to convicted felons acquiring liquor licenses by setting up fake corporations. When Rose read this in the papers, she remembered when Bob asked her to sign a form for the Casablanca Cafe. She hoped no one would come after her. Rose was devastated by Bob's death and how he'd died. She was still blind to Bob's flaws, despite what he'd done to Harry and the time he'd spent in prison. She flew to Cleveland to mourn him with Sadie and her brothers. Sam and Gazella were surprised and shocked by the news. They'd been unaware of Bob's activities. They could barely read English, so Bob and the rest of the family were able to keep news of his criminal activities secret. When he'd been in prison, they managed to cover it up with descriptions of business travel and lavish vacations he needed to take the clients to continue to build his business. Sam and Gazella never completely understood what business he was in, but accepted whatever Bob or his brothers told them as truth. Sadie and the children knew little more than did Sam and Gazella. Sadie kept the children busy, and they were rarely in contact with Bob's work associates. Sadie learned early not to ask questions or risk having to search her conscience before accepting Bob's lavish gifts of furs, jewelry, and cruises. Both Max and Izzy knew from the papers how deeply Bob had been into illegal activities and why he went to prison. Bob never shared information with them because he didn't want them to have to choose between squealing on their brother and the safety of their families. They'd chosen to ignore what he was doing and figured it was all behind Bob when he opened the Casablanca Cafe and went straight. Bob carried his last conversation with Harry about the Ash Weisskopf case to his grave. Before Harry received the telegram that said stop, Detective Wasserman had called Bob to warn him that Harry was skating on thin ice. He told Bob to tell his brother-in-law to cease his questioning about the outcome of the case. Listen, Bob, our friends are loud and clear. Harry snitched, so he owes them. Most snitches don't live very long. But he's your brother-in-law. They're willing to let it go if he works for them. They can send lots of business his way. What about me, Mikey? Do they have it in for me, too? You know, because I got Harry on board? No, they like you, Bob. You do what you're told, even if you're not that good at it, laughed Wasserman. Nah, not true. I'm very good, and you know it, Mikey. Okay, I'll talk to Harry. He'll wise up. He could make a lot of money. Thanks, Mikey. Bob called Harry. Harry, I know what's been going on. No need to say anything. Just listen, said Bob without introduction or small talk. He was calling from his home while his family was out. It was prearranged. Harry was using his landlord's phone. Harry, you gotta leave things be for your own good. I need to earn a living, Bob, and I have to live with myself, replied Harry, desperate. That's up to you, Harry, but there's nothing I can do. You're too honest for your own good. They'll be after Rose and your baby, too. What do you mean, Bob? I'll spell it out for you, Harry. You continue to talk about this case. You're finished. These guys mean business. I'm afraid they'll go after you, Rose, and even your kid. You should have kept your mouth shut. That's all I can say. I'm taking a risk calling you, but I'm doing it for Rose. Harry got angry and whispered harshly into the phone. They killed them both, Bob. They killed a juror and the prosecutor. You expect me to keep my mouth shut? Yeah, I do, Harry. Listen, I got a call. They're willing to let it go if you work for them. Take a case here and there. It's good money. Rose will love it. Harry took a sharp intake of breath. I'm not working for the mob. Then you're taking chances with your life and theirs. You already worked for them, don't you see? Look at it this way, Harry. Your name's been all over the papers. Who's going to let you work for them, huh? You didn't kill anyone. No, you didn't. But to them, you're connected. You worked with a crooked judge and crooked jurors, Harry. Bob hung up and debated with himself whether to tell his brothers what happened. He read about the case, but didn't know all that had happened afterward. He thought they should know because they would all need to help Rose by sending money when she needed it. In the end, he decided against telling anyone else. It was Harry's problem. He'd need to figure it out. Bob knew Harry would never practice law again because he'd be too afraid. And no law firm would want to hire him after his name was splashed all over the papers. He knew Rose wouldn't move out of New York unless it was to Cleveland. Harry finally hung up the phone, stunned. Bob's message was clear. The family was in danger. He regretted having taken the case in the first place. How could I have trusted Bob? I knew he was no good. I was so desperate for money and to make a name for myself in New York. He made the rounds again, hoping for a permanent job, but no one was interested. He couldn't even get freelancing anymore. There were rumors that Harry played a role in the deaths of Ryan Murphy and the juror, and in the judge and jury tampering. No charges were brought against him, but none of the law firms in New York would have anything to do with him. Shortly after the call from Bob, he received a letter from the New York State Bar Association. It said he was being considered for disbarment. He was shocked. The mob probably has people there too, he thought angrily. He had to confront the fact that he'd have to stop practicing law. It ate at him that his integrity had been violated. He was far from the naive bumpkin Bob thought him, but it was still a shock to think Wasserman, the judge, police chief, and DA were all corrupt, every last one of them. Feeding his family had to be the priority. The irony of his ethical dilemma was not lost on him. He could either sacrifice his integrity and self-respect to give his family some measure of prosperity, or adhere to his principles while risking starvation and perhaps death to punish corrupt law enforcement officers and gangsters. Harry decided to give up trying to get justice. He'd have to leave the dirty work to Elliot Ness. "Rose," Harry had said to his wife, "I don't think I should practice law anymore. Not after receiving that telegram." "What did that mean, Harry? You didn't want to tell me. It just said, stop." "It meant I had asked too many questions. Let's leave it at that. You have to trust me, Rose. It's better for us if I don't practice law anymore." Harry wasn't sure how much his wife knew about what had happened. She didn't read the papers, but she wrote to her brothers every Thursday, and they wrote to her. It could have served Bob's purpose to tell Rose everything, so she'd leave him again, this time for good. But then he'd have to reveal his part in what had happened. Bob wasn't cunning enough to make up a story that condemned Harry without condemning himself. He assumed Bob wouldn't tell Rose about the job offer from the mob. If he had, Harry guessed Rose would have pushed him to accept. She didn't care how they got the money as long as they did. But as much as Rose knew about Bob's prison time, she never held him responsible. "But what will you do? Would things be better if we went to Cleveland? Maybe Bob or Max could help you." Harry laughed. "No, Rose, Bob and Max, your saintly brothers, can't help me. I want to stay in New York. I don't want to live in Cleveland. I'll find something. I'll take care of you." Harry decided to take a risk. "Sit down, Rose. I have to come clean. It's about time you knew it was Bob who got me into this mess." "Let me finish. He got me the job defending Ash Weisskopf. He worked with his mob friends to force jurors and the judge to reach the innocent verdict. He and his pals knocked off a juror who squealed, and Ryan Murphy, the prosecutor. It was Bob, Rose. Do you hear me? Your saintly brother, Bob." He watched Rose's face as her expression wavered back and forth between anger and disbelief. "Rose," Harry continued more quietly, "I got a letter from the Bar Association. They've threatened to disbar me. They said if I want to keep any reputation at all, for whatever it's worth, I should stop practicing or they'll make it official." For once, Rose was silent. Harry left the room. He refused to go to Cleveland then and ever after. He didn't know what he would do if he encountered Bob face to face. Harry had given up a lot, but had to preserve some remnants of his dignity. Managing stores, however unsuccessful, was at least reputable. He slowly killed himself with pancakes and syrup, and later took what joy he could get from Natty and Abby. Rose had a breakdown. The trauma of losing Bob, Harry's news, and Abby's continued mental illness and subsequent problems with Ira were just too much for her. "I want Laura to move in and help me," said Rose after a rare night of giving herself to Herman. "I'm overwhelmed with everything." They were sitting in bed drinking coffee and eating bear claws she'd purchased the day before. It was a new type of pastry she was eager to try. Herman put down his coffee and moved to sit on the side of the bed, away from her. "I will not have it, Rose. I will not have that woman living here. What about me? I'm your husband. I'm supposed to help you through difficult times." "Ah, is that what last night was all about? Now I get it." She touched his back. "You're at work all day. Natty's at school. Abby's in the hospital. You don't want me working. She'll keep me company. So see her during the day, every day if you want, except when I'm home. She doesn't need to live here." Herman rose from the bed and started to dress. "Maybe she should be your husband. I've got to go to work." Laura moved in despite Herman's protests. Neither woman figured this was permanent, so she only brought a few things with her. She could always go back home to get more. Rose thrived under Laura's control. She was back to herself, eating and sleeping normally, spending money gratuitously. She didn't have to make decisions or plans. She remembered Harry saying she couldn't decide between chocolate and vanilla. Turned out, he was right. Laura took care of everything, even Herman. Herman went to work, traveling more than necessary so he could stay away from home. He loved Rose to the point of worshiping her, much like Harry had, because of some indefinable magnetism that drew men to her. Unlike with some other beautiful women, men didn't seem to lose interest, even after discovering she didn't have much to contribute to a marriage. It wasn't until they became frustrated with her indecision or her mistakes and poor judgment that they considered whether they were better off without her.